Hello and welcome to the November edition of Tech IE. Tech IE is a radio program put on by the New Hampshire section of the IEEE. The IEEE, also known as the Institute of Electronics and Electrical Engineers, is a worldwide organization of engineers working in all disciplines. IEEE, advancing technology for humanity. This month, I've got a great show for you guys. We have folks from the Amherst Makerspace here in our first segment. And for our second segment, we are going to talk about big data. So first up, I've got folks from the Amherst Makerspace. I've got Porter Dodge and Marcel Chabot. How you guys doing?
Awesome.
Doing great.
I heard about the Amherst Makerspace, and I heard that you guys are fairly new. Is that true?
Yep. Just started open enrollment in September to the community. And I'd been working on it all summer to try to pull the lab together and get all the tools set up and get everything clean and ready for use.
So one of the things I heard about you guys is that you're doing things different than the usual makerspace. What's different about how you guys are setting up your makerspace?
Well, we're coming together as a different type of angle. It's a part of the school system during the day, where students have classes in the space. They have all the resources of the makerspace during their industry and design classes. But at the evening, maker members that have their swipe cards can swipe at the door. It actually unlocks the door to the school and lets them into the wing that has the wood shop, the metal shop, the computer labs, all the printers and lasers and CNCs. They all become community resources after hours. So once the kids leave, all the parents and other adults in the community can use the tools. We joke around that last year at 4:30, they turn off the lights and all the tools got lonely. Now we can come back in and use them all. And it's something that most people didn't even know was there. They'd come in for a tour and they'd see all the tools and go, wow, I wish I had this type of shop. And now we're like, well, you can. And it's providing something through the rec department of our town and through the school.
That's really neat. So rather than have the stuff sitting there idle half the day, you've opened it up so that people can come in and use it at night. You're talking about people having access to the school. That sounds to me like that would be something difficult to arrange. How did that come about? I mean, how would you arrange that with the local school?
Well, initially, as Marcel mentioned, the school was basically unused in the evenings except for sports in the gymnasium. The idea that we had an excellent area down in our innovation and design wing. It wasn't called innovation and design at the time. It was typical shop, as most people out there would remember, and home ec and that type of thing.
Yeah, I remember industrial arts.
And so historically, it was those machines weren't used. They were in many cases unsafe at the time or considered that. At one time, even engineers, when they were putting an addition on our school, had said that they think we ought to use that room for classrooms. And we said no. It was a niche for a lot of kids that really loved it. Probably 3 years ago, I attended a workshop with a man named Eric Scheninger, who was a principal of New Milford High School in New Milford, New Jersey. And he was the innovative teacher of the year. And he came up with this idea, not of makerspace, but of utilizing his library to have an area where the kids could do that, and then it became part of a makerspace unit there just during the day.
Okay.
I came back and brought pictures. I gave them to Brad Freeman, our network administrator, who's in the room here. Brad had already been looking at the makerspace idea. I was trying to fuse the innovation design area. He was really the makerspace person. I kind of get a lot of the credit for it being the principal, but it really wasn't my idea any more than a few others.
Right.
And then we were lucky enough to have a school board that was really interested in STEM and STEAM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and had the arts in there for the STEAM. And so it was a perfect storm. They were willing to let us run with this idea. Brad ran with the makerspace. I continue with the innovation and design.
Yeah.
And the equipment gets to be used, as Marcel says, for dual use.
That's cool. But what's the difference between innovation and design and the makerspace?
Well, a lot and then none. I mean, the system where we had our innovation design lab had computer labs in there, had art rooms with kilns and that type of thing, a family and consumer science area with sewing and cooking. What we did is fuse those together, trying to make them more modern,
Okay.
And by making them more modern, we wanted to go more with the science and technology. So instead of, you know, just wood products, we went to metal, to all kinds of other things in the electronics and all that. And that's where I think it really started to fly, because we bought kits with things for the kids to use in the innovation design labs.
Yeah.
And then once the town got involved in the makerspace, they said, we can offer classes using the kilns. We can use the computer labs. We can do coding. We can, and the machinery that we have, the 3D printers and all those things, got to be used not only by our kids, but now by adults in the community. And these guys, you know, Marcel and Brad, and our innovation design teacher, Steve Opry, who was an engineer himself,
They've
just flown with this thing. It makes my job real easy. I just have to try to find money, that's all. And they really have just done the most of the work, Herculean effort.
And one of the things that makes the Amherst Middle School really conducive to this is that all these classrooms were in one wing. And the school is kind of shaped like the letter Y. And that one whole section was just the innovation and design wing. So to make it safe for the school, so that we could let, you know, community members in without having to do a whole lot of vetting to be able to allow them into the facility, we put a gate up at one end of the hall and we close it and lock it when it's just makerspace time.
Gotcha.
And that gets them all the way down to the only bathroom on that wing. And that's it. So we can lock off that whole section and isolate it from the rest of the building. We also have honesty enforced by cameras, which
right.
you want to have when you have people walking in using your power tools.
Well, what kind of tools are available in the makerspace?
Well, we've got a lot of wood tools, your common band saws, table saws. We also have MIG welding and a lot of woodworking pieces. We've got a shear and a brake and for wood, planers, joiners, all the things that you would expect there. We have hand tools for the other type of simple woodworking. And then as you move over to what we call the clean side, we've got a laser cutter engraver, a vinyl cutter, two 3D printers, a continuous roll printer so you can actually print color banners.
Yeah.
We just got a community member donated a 1 meter by 1 meter CNC to us. So now we have a new wood CNC that just showed up in the, I can't wait to see what the kids do with it during the day and the adults do with it at night. It's a really fantastic piece of equipment. So we had all that in the, those two rooms. Plus we have the two kilns, the four station kitchen, and the two computer labs for classes.
Oh, wow. So sounds like a lot of stuff.
The sewing as well in there. And also in the dirty side, if you will, there's also, we have welding equipment. They offered some of the first courses that were offered was welding. And I got on that. Marcel was in that very first one. Brad was in that very first one. And it's just an awesome opportunity for community members to get involved.
Okay, so yeah, that sounds awesome. That sounds like a lot of good stuff. I would expect to see all that kind of stuff in a makerspace.
Yeah, I think it's 10,000 square. How many square feet did we agree that was? 11,000 square feet, about, which puts us at a pretty good size makerspace. Now, there's compromises we had to make.
Yeah, I would assume so. Like,
It is a school.
Yeah.
So whatever you bring in to work with in the makerspace, we have to vet.
Gotcha.
So toxic chemicals, we have to worry about those things. You can't put PVC in the laser because the chloride part of polyvinyl chloride is bad to release into a school.
Right.
We're also a pack-in, pack-out shop during school days. Because if I brought into a school full of middle schoolers a block of solid aluminum and just left it there, by the time I got back the next day, it'd be broken in half and some kid would be there going, "Oh, it was that way when I got here."
Right.
So anything you bring in, you bring home, unless it's Friday night, Saturday night, or during the summer when there is no school. So we have some restrictions like that. And to that extent, we keep the membership costs and all those pieces proportional to what we're allowed to do.
Yeah. So what are the hours that the space is available for makers?
4:30 to 11 on school days and 7 to 11 on weekends and days the school is not open.
Okay. 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.?
Yep.
Oh, wow. That's really awesome. So I can only imagine some of the conversations that had to go in it had to be had in order to make this possible. I think, Porter, you mentioned the school board and some other people who were helpful and were enthusiastic. Could you talk maybe a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mentioned it as being a perfect storm in some ways. We were pushing the STEM and STEAM idea, our school board was, our superintendent, Peter Warburton, all wanting us to try to modernize that area. As I mentioned before, there were tools and things that had dust on them and stuff hadn't been used. And also we wanted to get the engineering idea in there, electronics and that type of thing. So it was a perfect storm in that they said, run with it. And we had people who wanted to run with it. So we were just very lucky. They brought it to the school board. We talked about it on television. They were very glad that we were going this way. And they have been so interested in it and followed it. Peter Warburton has brought people in. Guests have been in. Our school board have all been in to see this area during the day, and they're just amazed at the things that kids are doing right now. You just would not picture this area 3 years ago. It's nothing like it.
Oh, and that's awesome.
It's really exciting. I can't tell you as a principal how great it is to see kids doing things with their hands, learning electronics and how to weld and how to braze and all that stuff. Just powerful, powerful stuff. And they're all engaged in it now because it's something they really love to do.
That's great.
And on the community side, we've got the Amherst Rec Department with Craig and Amber. They kind of do a lot of the background work for the community side. If I want to put together a class on programming Arduino, I did this one last year, and it was a fantastic class. We had a great time. All I have to do is send Amber, this is the class I want to have. These are the days I'm going to do it. This is what it's going to cost to run the class because there's equipment to buy. Everyone gets, you know, pieces to bring home. And I just send her the stats for the class, and they do all the advertising. They do all the handling of collecting student fees and managing the roster. So as an instructor, I tell the rec department what I'm interested in teaching, and then I show up on the day of my class ready to go, and there's a full room of people there to teach.
Oh, that's great.
They leverage a lot to make that happen, and it's great to have that kind of support. That as an engineer, I am not so good at designing, you know, that whole outreach program, but it's already there. So it lets the Makerspace team members do what they want, they do best, which is engineering and that type of technical stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I could see how that would be helpful. As an engineer myself, I dealing with people and reaching out to people is not my first love. Let me just put it that way. So what recommendations would you have for other towns or people in other towns who think this is a great idea and might want to have something similar happen in their town?
Contact us. I mean, we really are willing to share. There's no secrets to this, you know, especially where we're looking at very few, if any, schools that are combined with the towns in such a relationship that they're using these facilities. Yet I'll bet there's schools all over the place that have these things, many of the equipment lying dormant.
Yeah.
And so if they want to see how it works, and we're glad to show them anything. This is a great movement. The Makerspace movement itself is awesome. To get the maker movement into a school and in the community is just added on. It's value added. So if they want to contact the middle school, they can. They want to contact the Amherst Makerspace. I'm sure we'll be throwing some of those little plugs out there for their website and things like that. We'll be glad to help them. No charge. This is what we do. We're a school and we want to teach. And we'll be glad to teach every other community if they want to do it. They can come visit us, too, anytime.
And there's a lot the schools can gain from this. Just the sharing of tools. Steve's 3D printers are never out of Cal. Every Thursday, I'm in there for an open house. I'll sit down, and the 3D printers are my favorite two tools there. So I'll be in there calibrating, cleaning them, and everything's always ready for his class. So in the evening, people kind of help the students have the high-end tools without increasing Porter's cost to maintain these exotic devices. Having a CNC is a bit of maintenance, but we have people who really like the CNC and like to see it running for everybody. The students win there. It's really great.
That is great. So Porter, you mentioned a plug, so I think that's a good idea. So why don't you guys plug your websites?
Right now, the easiest way to find us is the Amherst Makerspace on Facebook. Just hit us up there. We'll let you be a member, and you can see what we're doing. You can see when our open houses are. It's usually on Thursdays from 6 to 9. You're welcome to come on by. Just drive around the back of the middle school where the baseball diamonds are. The door, well, it's getting cold out, so it probably won't be propped open all the way now. but you're welcome to just come on in. We'll show you around the area. We'll introduce you to some of the other board members that are there on Thursdays. If you decide to be a member, we'll give you your safety checks and your access card, and off you go.
That's awesome. So do you need to be a member or a, not a member, but somebody that lives in Amherst to be a member?
Nope, it's open to everybody.
Cool. And what's the name of the middle school?
It's the Amherst Middle School.
Oh, yep. Okay.
Yes.
I come from a place where everything gets named. When I was growing up, we had a name for the elementary school and a name for the middle schools and so on. So, okay, Amherst Middle School.
Yep. Yes.
That's great. I'm a firm believer that kids need to get their hands on. I mean, when I was a kid, I was taking apart blenders and clock radios and putting them back together with mixed success. And the past couple of years, my wife has been involved with the Girl Scouts, and we've had the girls from her troop over, and we showed them how to use a drill and hammer a nail and even how to bake. And it's really sad that some of these kids just haven't been exposed to this.
Well, that's one of the cool things that we're doing at the Makerspace as well, is that as it's controlled by the Makerspace founders, our group pretty much has access to all that space. It takes a lot of overhead out of the school for managing those resources.
Yeah.
So we have this Girl Scouts coming by looking for classes, looking to utilize the resources for their programs. We have DI, Destination Imagination. They're using the space to work on their projects. We're able to share the space to more of the community by offloading the scheduling, by lessening some of the rules to be able to allow ad hoc meetings. We're really opening up the space to more and more people. And we have people coming in going, they want to do a mother-daughter engineering class, or they want to do a women-only woodcraft, or a father-son project, or that all these people are coming out of the woodwork that now we have space and tools and a facility that's very, very accessible. All you need is your swipe card, and boom, it opens up the 1,100 square feet 11,000 square feet of space that they can come in and use. It's very attractive for these smaller groups that can't meet somewhere that has enough tools and space.
Gotcha. So while we were chatting before we started, I think, Porter, you mentioned that you knew each other?
Yes. I had Marcel as a student in my, when I was teaching eighth grade social studies back in the day. Marcel, you remember what year that was?
No, I'm not going to admit what year right. It was. I'll do you the favor.
It was more than 2 years ago anyway, but he was a great student. And when I saw him back when we took the first class in welding together for the very first class in the Makerspace, there he was. And so we reintroduced, and Charles in the school, and it's just awesome. It's a great opportunity to reconnect.
Yeah, it's really cool that the Makerspace, as a team, the board we have is very, very welcoming. If there's anything you want to do, anything you're interested in, you can swing by and like, yes, let's do that. Let's give that a try. We built a great group of people that are trying to outreach more. We're always looking for tools, sponsorship opportunities, donations. We can always use donations.
Okay.
We're short on hand tools. Pie in the sky. We'd love to add a lift, a car lift for the community side. I can't imagine my 10-year-old under a car lift at Porter's school. But, you know, expanding it out to some stuff that's specific for the community makers and adding more tools for the kids in the classes.
So just a practical question. What is the cost to be a member?
If you want just a single person, it's $20 a month. If it's your whole family, it's $30 a month. It's really cheap.
Yeah, that sounds really reasonable. And for the safety check, I would imagine, well, what's involved with that?
Right now, all the tools can be powered up by pushing the on button. So before we can allow you to swipe yourself into the whole Makerspace area, you have to go through all the wood shop tools, all the tools that could be turned on. You need to be made sure that you are safe around them. In the coming months, we'll be adding lockouts to them. So your Makerspace badge will be inserted into a slot on the control board. That will activate the tool if you're allowed to use it, which lowers our fear of somebody turning on a tool that they don't know how to use.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And that will help our school too, because when we want to use those tools for, we have one teacher in our innovation design, Steve Opry, as I mentioned, he'll be able to go in and swipe a machine, knowing a child has been trained on it. He can swipe it, allow them to use it and watch it. He can control how many are being used because, again, you bring 18 kids into a classroom. We know that safety is always important. That's the most important thing, especially in there with children and power tools. But we want them to be able to use them.
Right.
So once this is done, this is going to be an absolutely powerful way for us to keep the class very safe.
I'm just amazed that nobody's thought about doing this kind of thing yet. It's the first I've heard of this kind of partnership, and I think this is a great idea. Where do you see taking this idea? Where do you want to see this makerspace go?
Well, from a community side, I'd like to see us have between 50 and 80 continuous members. Makerspaces, members come and go. Some people have summer projects. Some people have winter projects. It depends on the engineer and what they feel like doing and when they want to come out of the closet and play with toys and when they rather go out and be in the sun or something. I don't. So I'd like to see between 50 and 80 continuous members using the space and being able to expand our collection of tools and equipment. And the big thing with a makerspace is not the space, it's the people in it.
Right.
And I'd like to keep seeing that community grow, where it's a larger and larger resource for the rest of the town, where if the conservation committee wants to build bridges in the Panema Bog, that there's a resource at the makerspace where they can come by on an open house and go, this is the project, and people jump up to say, hey, I want to do that. We could have a directory of people that have skill sets and start building not just a resource of tools, but a resource of people and a resource of talent that can be tapped by the school to help with classes and engineering there and by the rest of the community as well.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. My understanding of most makerspaces is that you walk in, you become a member, and then if you want to learn how to do something, use something, you ask another member and they sort of show you how to do things. And I would imagine that's how you see this makerspace playing out as well.
Indeed.
So, yeah, I think that would be an awesome thing to have this community available. Because I know you've talked about classes, Marcel. So, yeah, having a less formal instruction, I guess, where just being able to ask other members would be fantastic.
Yep.
So what kind of classes do you guys have lined up already?
Let's see, we've got an interesting class coming up for this neat time window we have between when the last bus leaves and when the adults start to come into the makerspace, where we're doing some Minecraft classes, Minecraft modding classes with the kids. So that's going from 4:30 to 6,
okay,
starting in January. We'll have some more Arduino classes coming up, some Raspberry Pi classes, software-defined radio. We will be having, I'm trying to remember all the ones we had come by. There's really great woodworking classes that are starting to queue up. We have people that are in the surrounding area that have talents that would like to share them, and they're showing up to talk about what they want to instruct and how they want to do this.
Okay, so I know that there are IEEE members who would love to share their expertise and what they know. So if they wanted to have a class or something, how would they go about doing that?
You can email me directly or come through the Facebook page. It's probably the best way to go. Most of our board members are watching. You can request to be let in. We let everybody who makes a request join. It's just so that if somebody causes trouble, we can send them out.
Right.
But join in, come by for an open house, post what you'd like to teach on the Facebook page, and we'll talk about it. I haven't turned down a single class offer as long as we had the equipment in space.
Porter, I feel like I should ask you more questions.
Well, that's okay. As I said, it's a makerspace night, but everything that the makerspace can offer is exciting because our kids, it's dual use, as I said. So that's the exciting part. if we get a new piece of equipment, unless it's a safety issue or whatever, we will be able to use that as well. So this is just, you know, it's a great relationship that we have. The Amherst Rec, as you mentioned, Craig Fraley from our recreation director is on board. They handle all the paperwork for this. We're the beneficiaries of it.
Yeah.
We're trying, it's organic right now. So there's not, it's not an idea of making money, but we have the facilities and the tools and those things there already. Our belief is let's use them. Let's get the kids using them, learning how to do it. So much has been said in recent years about that everybody is not going to go to Harvard, that there is a tremendous demand out there for skilled labor in particular areas. Yep. We want to get these kids making these choices when they're in grades 5 through 8. They don't know what they want to do yet. I want to expose them to it and let them make some decisions. And we're working with Sohegan High School, our sister high school, which is 200 yards across the way, and the engineering classes and physics classes there are saying, you know, we're saying, what can we do? What can we do to help? And one of the really neat things that I'd like to mention is that going in, we brought some people in to see them building trebuchets in grade 6. Well, most 6th graders don't know what a trebuchet is. These kids were building them and having competition. When they get to the high school, they build giant trebuchets and they have real chucking contests with those things in their physics. So we talked to the teachers over there and they said, get the kids introduced to this and then we won't have to spend all of that time introducing all the physics of it. We can get into the deeper physics, if you will. And so that partnership there with the high school is very important too. We're looking at possibly having some of their really top physics students, or not necessarily top, but kids who are interested coming over and using our equipment at times when it's available for them. What a great idea. We're two separate districts. People don't realize that.
Oh, okay.
It's Sohegan High School. It's Sohegan Cooperative School District. It's Mount Vernon and Amherst. And we're the Amherst Middle School, which is just Amherst and Mount Vernon students in grades 7 and 8 come into our school and tuition in. So this is just a tremendous opportunity for us to get the high school involved. Those kids, they have community service for National Honor Society, and it's a big part of their graduation requirement. So they can come over and work with us, giving extra hands in the classrooms. It's really exciting, the things that we can do educationally for our kids as well.
The other thing we're looking for the daytime program is being able to find engineers in the community that have skill sets that they'd like to apply and maybe assist in the labs and the wood shop and the 3D printers and through that whole area, that even though they're retired engineers, they're still engineers, and engineers to the core, I'm sure. And they could come by and share those skills and that education with the kids at the middle school. We're calling it RETAP. It's Retired Engineers Teaching Assistance Program. Remembered it.
I like it. RETAP.
RETAP, I like it.
And we're looking for people to come by and apply and help out with the kids and help Steve in his class and be able to take that knowledge that they have and bring it to the kids for things that Steve might not know, or this instructor can be Steve's assistant for, doesn't even have to be a whole year. It could be a 1 month program of coming by and helping do some instructor and some project work.
Yeah, Porter, I'm just going to ask you one a little question. You talked a little bit about the trebuchets and the students getting more involved. So you're seeing that more students are getting excited or engaged by the learning that's going on in the classroom because of the makerspace?
Very much, very much. I mean, there are things that are of interest to them. Not to knock an old-fashioned program, but when I grew up, it was shop and it was home ec. And now,
same here, yeah.
Yes, and then there were no computers. I'm dating myself now. There were absolutely no computers. But now with these facilities opened up to the children with electronics, we're trying to get our girls very interested in engineering. It's an area where there's just not a great interest, and with these girls are with it. They can get it. We have to show them. And so walking in one of the days that our school board members came in, a couple of them to see, they were huddled around a table and they went over to ask and they looked and there were two young ladies teaching the boys how to braze and how to solder. Excellent things. And they said, whoa, well, it shouldn't be that way. It should be anybody in the class, but it hasn't been that in the past.
Right.
And so what we're doing is, this is a real interest, and we're seeing the kids, that competition when I mentioned about the trebuchets. The girls won the trebuchet contest. They went almost a third longer because they made the design based on some other physics rather than just making this big broody thing. And so those are the kind of things that if we can get those girls and everybody, but the girls especially, in seventh and eighth grade to start heading right in that direction of engineering, if that's an interest they have when they get to the high school, instead of waiting to take one class in the high school and say, oh boy, I think I'd like to go to, you know, MIT or whatever, you know, so.
Right.
My daughter cannot wait to get into Mr. Opry's class. I have to be careful because I call him Steve while we're there, and she has to call him Mr. Opry. And she cannot wait. She's dying for it.
That's awesome.
And I've had many parents. I mean, we open house night just saying how wonderful it is, how bright and how open it is and how exciting their kids are. And boy, when you get parents taking the time to tell you how excited they are about an innovation and design lab, and just as much as they are about the science class, and yeah. that says it all. I mean, they really are. And I've had letters written where people have thanked us. They're thanking me, but they're thanking us for getting their child rejuvenated.
That's
huge. Not everybody is great at particular areas of what we call our core.
Yeah.
But boy, they're flying in this.
That's great. Yeah. So unfortunately, we're running out of time, so we're going to have to wind this down. But I really appreciate you guys coming out tonight. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that we haven't covered yet?
No, I'm looking forward to more people showing up. I'm looking forward to meeting new people. Check out the Amherst Makerspace Facebook page to join and get the latest news. We'll get our own page up sooner or later. One of the things with being makerspace driven is that we're all volunteers. So some things get done when they get done.
Yep, I hear that.
And as far as the schools go, very important that if you're listening out there and you have a child in the school and you want to get them, they're invited to come see us, we're glad to have them come. We really are. And I'm sure that through the connections, they can let their principals know. And we'll bring him in, give him a tour, and help him out any way we can.
Marcel Porter, thank you for coming, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
So, setting up for our second segment, I'd like to take a moment to say congratulations to the Alton Bay School for winning the IEEE grant, and also for the Guilford High School, for they also won an IEEE grant. If you are an educator and you're listening and you don't know about the IEEE grants, please check it out at IEEE-NH.org. It's a great way to help out your STEM-oriented classroom activities. And I'd also like to remind the IEEE members that we are going to be having a section mixer on January 20th at the Puritan Back Room. So when you see it, announced, please register for it so that we know how many folks to expect. I think you're going to have a great time. With that out of the way, let's talk about our next topic this month. It's going to be big data. What is it? How is it used? What is it good for? Joining me for this is Stephanie Collins of SNHU. Hi, Stephanie.
Good evening.
And Jim Isaac. How you doing, Jim?
Very well, Ed.
Let's get right into it, folks. I know, Jim, that you did a talk not too long ago on big data. How about if you lead off by maybe describing for the folks what we mean when people say big data?
Well, I think the first message is big data is getting bigger all the time. What happened, really, is the convergence of three critical technologies. We've been making computers that are getting much larger capacity in RAM and disk capacity. So we're talking about going from megabytes to gigabytes and from gigabytes of disk to terabytes. So the ability to reach large amounts of data directly from a single computer has increased in combination with multiprocessors and literally multiprocessor arrays that now can access thousands of times more because you literally build buildings where you put 1,000 of those things in the same building. And then finally, software that can actually try and manage data stretched across thousands of computers, often located in multiple locations around the world. So what we thought of as big data, say the Library of Congress, has become a noise level amount of material compared to what you can actually manage with something like Google or Amazon or Facebook and these very large systems that operate globally and maintain and contain massive amounts of information.
So you're saying that big data is not just about things. It's also about people and their behaviors as well.
Big data is everything. We just finished a presidential election, and one of the things that played a major role in that has been big data, you know, managing what used to be a view of voters by demographic groups. You know, how are the people in this precinct going to vote, or how are this, you know, age group or this racial group or this community going to vote? We're down to the point where we're now asking, how does this individual vote?
Yeah, I know in the past they've talked about the Latino vote or the millennial vote or whatever, and now you're saying they can just track or have an idea of how each individual voter is going to vote.
Yes.
Wow.
They literally generate out lists where the objective is to identify a specific voter, and if they have confidence that that voter, usually because of prior interactions, is likely to vote for a particular candidate, then that candidate's staff is in charge of contacting them and making sure they get to the polls.
Well, that sounds kind of sinister.
It would be sinister if there was one person only that was directing everything. But one of the characteristics of big data is it has many, many sources. Data is collected every time there's any kind of transaction. Buy an ice cream cone, that's a transaction. If you paid for it with a credit card and can be identified, that's stored somewhere. Do anything that can be identified, and that's stored somewhere. And all those different somewheres are not necessarily owned by the same group or individuals, but they can be all gathered together to build a picture of an individual.
You said the data isn't all in one place, but for all the credit card data, it exists. Axiom Corporation in Little Rock, Arkansas is one place that collects and makes that available to people for a price. Again, how far they individualize it, I'm not sure I even know. But and then other sources of data, other information. Now, if I want to know you're a diabetic, I don't need to go to your doctor and violate HIPAA. All I need to do is watch your Google searches.
Exactly. Are you trying to buy test strips?
Sure.
If you're buying test strips, there's no other reason.
So you can just infer a lot from a person by these different pieces of information.
And as long as you can link them all together, you can build a pretty accurate picture of an individual.
The change that's taken place in big data is 20 years ago, it was impossible to conceive of trying to maintain or track data at the level we're talking about. But we now have the capacity in terms of systems and the facilities in terms of the network to actually capture the data and store it ad infinitum.
Right. And now with the Internet of Things, by the way, plug, we did this last month. we talked about the Internet of Things, right, Stephanie?
Yeah.
So now with the Internet of Things, we don't have just people creating data by their actions. We also have these devices creating data points.
Absolutely. What is my car telling my insurance company or telling the car manufacturer or through my cell phone talking to my cell phone supplier or whatever about me and my, you know, contacted by an insurance company a while back, and they said, gee, we'd like to put this little device in your car and we'll give you a discount on your insurance. And I said, is that little device going to monitor everything I do? I said, well, of course it is. And what speed am I allowed to go if I have that device in my car? I said, well, anything over 80 miles an hour would be considered, you know, unsafe driving, no matter what the actual speed limit is. I drive in states where 80 is, in fact, the speed limit. And then you have...
We are all sort of suckers for the newest technologies. So a lot of people are putting all sorts of things in their homes that are basically watching them. The thermostat that knows what temperature you like to have in your kitchen versus your living room versus your bedroom, what time you go to bed, your lights, you can control, well, your garage door opener, if it's connected to the internet,
can
tell how often you come in and out. There's nothing to put a camera on it, and we're all concerned about security, and people are putting cameras on their doorbells and an internet-connected crock pot. Really? There are such things, by the way. This is not...
Well, that's so that when you're at work, you can turn it on or turn it off.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
It's really a crock, actually.
Well, and then there's all the smartphones. Everybody carries at least one.
Yes.
And that's, if you've got your location tracker turned on, that's also keeping track of where you are at exactly. any given time.
In well, almost every photograph that you post on the internet in any of the various services available, quite often done with a cell phone, quite often contains the longitude and latitude of that particular...
Yeah, know. The newer cell phones all do now.
Right.
They put location on pictures.
Right.
And so now people not only can identify where you were, when you were there, and with face recognition, identify who's actually in the picture. It creates all sorts of interesting possibilities.
And that's all data.
Yeah.
It's all data.
So yeah, George Orwell had this book, 1984. Kids, if you haven't read it, please do, about society monitoring each member. And I guess we've done it to ourselves then, haven't we?
Yes, we don't need the government to install that. I had one of my students tell me the other day that he knows where each one of his friends is at that very moment because he can track their phones with his phone.
And Pokemon Go is a good example of an entity that is, in fact, not only, of course, telling you where the Pokemons are, but it's also tracking all the individuals who are playing the game and where they are and allowing that information to be used by retailers to draw you into their stores or to provide special offers or whatever else they might want to do.
Yeah. Note to listeners, we also did a show on Pokemon Go, so you might want to check that out. So, yeah, I guess retailers can become a Pokestop and to lure in Pokemon players that way.
The idea that, you know, we used to be afraid, people used to be afraid of the government monitoring them.
Well,
not only do we do it to ourselves, but we pay for the privilege. Well, a lot of software development has been has been done to look at this kind of data. In the past, whenever we wanted to look at large amounts of data, that data had to all be sort of in the same format. You had pre-written routines to look at specific parts of the data. Now we have software that can look at data in lots of different formats, doesn't have to be consistent with each other, and you can ask a question any way you want to with a lot of these web-based services that you can now get, and they'll crawl the web for you and find the data that you want.
Wow.
Siri, where is my ex-wife, and what is she doing right now?
Yes.
That's an interesting question.
Especially since I don't have an ex-wife. But it's data analytics is part of that software. But now I front end that with AI technology, the voice recognition stuff, but below that, the understanding stuff. You know, if I look at Watson and what it is able to do in terms of learning models and in terms of being able to extract information out of these diverse sources, you're looking at a radically different world, probably even 5 years from now, in terms of what can be done with the whole data analytics and interpretation and anticipation.
So now we can anticipate what you're going to do, Ed, in the next 10 minutes.
Well, the phrase for that is predictive analytics. And if you've seen the movie A Minority Report, and watch it and now remember that it no longer takes people with ESP or whatever the specialized people in that movie were that allowed them to anticipate the future. We can now anticipate where a crime is going to occur in a given city at a given time and with a reasonable probability who the perpetrator will be, which is predictive analytics. Same philosophy that I'll use to decide whether you're likely to buy a pizza in the next 24 hours or whether you're likely to be interested in buying a stock from your broker.
Well, yeah, that gets to the next question I wanted to address is how is big data used? I mean, we've talked about how it's used to market to people, whether that's to market goods to them or market candidates to them. Jim, you brought up another one just now, which is using predictive analytics to determine where a crime might occur and who it might be as the perpetrator. But what are the ways that big data gets used? there must be more than just these two examples.
Well, I don't know if it's being used yet, but can you see the possibility if I know what factors will influence you, if I want to make you do something, how do I initiate those factors around you to make sure that you do that thing, whatever it happens to be?
I see. Manipulation.
Exactly. I can predict whether you're going to like purple or green for a sweatshirt, depending on other things I know about you. But how can I manipulate you to buy that purple sweatshirt? Gotcha. If I want you to do that or whatever else I want you to do?
People, so you're marketing.
It's a kind of marketing, but it's more than just marketing. Because now, instead of just presenting you with a good and telling you how wonderful it is, now I'm pushing you toward a particular outcome. And that particular outcome could have lots of different things. It could be an action.
Gotcha.
You're not just buying something, you're doing something. So
you already hit that example with the Pokemon sites, where the retailers, you know, puts together a special deal and attracts people with the Pokemon community in. Now the question is, can they attract in specific individuals, not just anybody who happens to be wandering by? And that combination provides for a number of opportunities and a number of opportunities for abuse.
Yeah, could be, you know, if I want to cause, well, we've seen something, these flash mobs.
Right.
And that was much more explicit. If you're interested, show up in this square and somebody will bring a music instrument or some kind of boombox or something, and then we'll all dance in the square. And then we'll all just, you know, go away. We don't know each other, but we're part of this flash mob.
Gotcha.
Well, what if I start choosing people who all have a specific characteristic that I want to emphasize, come to the square and start breaking windows or whatever it is? You know, give them the right trigger, they'll do it.
Gotcha.
Well, you asked earlier, and Stephanie jumped into the future just a small distance, but you asked, what are we doing with big data today? And of course, I don't think anybody goes a day without touching big data. And the most obvious one is Google search. It's a blatant example of massive, yes, amounts of data readily at your fingertips. Amazon, you know, I log into Amazon, it says, hi, Jim, here are some things that you might like. Now, that's a combination of big data and strong personalization. So every one of these significant websites we touch is collecting data about us, and you can actually watch the competition between websites to become your primary, you know, source of whatever, and in return, they become the person who owns your data and manages that to their benefit and to the benefit of their clients who pay for it, as opposed to their competitors.
Right. Well, last night I was doing some search on Cassandra, which is a NoSQL database, and for big data, for those of you that haven't heard of it before. One of the ads that came up was from Amazon Web Services. It says, we have big data for MLB. And then it took me a minute to puzzle that out. Well, they had a silhouette of a baseball player. And I'm like, really, big data is now being marketed to the fantasy sports fan to put together their fantasy baseball teams or football teams.
Right.
Or, you know. So I thought that was amusing.
Well, it's amusing, but everyone sort of pictures themselves as being, I don't know who that manager was out in California that built a baseball team and hired a bunch of...
Oh, the Oakland A's, the Moneyball movie, right?
Right. Everybody thinks of themselves as, well, if I had enough data, I too could be a Moneyball manager. And it's interesting to see how people react to that possibility, or whatever else. I do happen to know somebody who is an analyst of data specifically for sports. And he spends quite a bit of time doing analytics to see what the value is of a particular athlete, because that number is then used to negotiate the athlete's salary when the athlete signs with a particular team. Well, he makes good money at it because he's very good at it.
Right.
You know, but, well, if Amazon will help me, maybe I too could be very good at it, even though I know almost nothing about any of the sports like football or baseball.
Right. There's a word slipping out here, and I think we need to be careful of it. We talk about they are collecting, you know, this and that, and we're not talking about human beings here. We're talking
about
automated systems that do it, obviously managed by people for whatever intents those people have. But this is happening without human intervention. It's happening without human judgment, without human ethics being applied to it. Those all come in after the fact when somebody decides that something may be inappropriate or wrong or problematic. Then all of a sudden you see that issue popping up. But we work off of just plain straight data snapped up by computers and without hesitation stored for future use.
So doesn't somebody have to set up some sort of filter or net or something to say, hey, I'm interested in that data?
Well,
that's what the software does. No, anyone can cut through that data in any direction they want. You specify, so for example, if you use Amazon Web Services, you know what that piece of data is. Well, you know what an object is that's collecting the data and what kind of data is going to be collected by a particular object. And you see this big store of data and you say, well, I want to see how many men typically will buy purple socks. I'll use that as an example.
Okay.
And you tell the machine that's what you want. The software basically crawls through that data and gives you its prediction. The machine has no moral judgment.
Right.
It's just data.
Well, and you mentioned NoSQL, which is one of the steps away from, just to put people in historical context, SQL is referred to as structured query language. And the idea is that you had structured data and you expressed your needs for information from that data based on a language that was also extremely structured. And the result was you could pull back the data you wanted. What happened is two things. First of all, people wanted to ask questions that were not well-structured, that didn't necessarily follow the rules, and people wanted to use data that wasn't well-structured. So NoSQL is one of the efforts to provide that capability. The second thing is getting rid of the underlying structured database altogether. And in order to accomplish that, Hadoop is a tool set that has been put in the open source community to manage massive amounts of data without necessarily having any implicit structure to it. The structure is defined at the time the data is collected, essentially.
So it's almost like, what is that, stream of consciousness, data processing. Whatever you want, when you want it, and we'll just troll through whatever exists and see what turns up.
Gotcha.
It's not as predictable as with structured data. With structured data, you've got to know what you're asking for.
Right, and you've got to set up your data in a certain way to be able to ask that question.
Exactly. With all these unstructured data sets that are floating around, you can ask a question like, what did I forget? What didn't I ask? Of course, you're going to get a big set back.
Right.
But then you can start narrowing it down.
I would imagine that big data is also used to tease out patterns, for example, in research data.
Oh, absolutely. It's tremendously useful. There have been a lot of advances in the sciences using big data, because if you can see all the data rather than just a sample of the data, you might be able to see patterns in things. Patterns of diseases among different groups of people or in different parts of the world or something that might not have been as obvious because you couldn't see the whole data set. Now you can. Or you can see correlations between different kinds of activities and perhaps some diseases or some syndromes, and that would help determine what the best course of action is, you know. But not necessarily causality, but correlations, you know.
Right.
So you have lots of different ways to explore problems. So that's useful.
Let me come back to one of your examples, Stephanie, because I can give you a specific instance of it, which was disclosed in one of the TED Talks, and that's with a website called Patients Like Me. Now, the instance that's interesting is there was a study done in Sweden about a specific medication and how it affected a certain disease, and they had 13 patients in the study, and they came up with a curve that showed how the medication affected the patients, and 13 patients is not very many, but it's enough to justify going to a larger scale study. The fellow running the Patients Like Me website saw that study. He turned around his site, which now has 20 or 30,000 people involved with it, and tested to see who had the particular characteristics that the study involved and was taking that medication for other reasons, because quite often you're already taking the medication for problem A and you also happen to have problem B. And then he ran this study. He got 8,000 people or something in his study, and it was 24 hours after the Swedish study became public. So it went from small scale to large scale just because of the availability of a large amount of data and the ability to query it and find what was there.
I think
that's really wild.
Yeah, and then it being on the internet, and well, probably the people who participated don't have to disclose to a person necessarily. They disclose what they want to disclose. I think you probably get more accurate data. I know that, you know, you go to the doctor and sometimes the doctor asks you about several problems and you might be a little shy about saying whatever.
Right.
But you might be much more open about it on a website that you think is anonymous, where you are anonymous. You right. have a code number and then you can tell them anything because they don't know who you are. Well, you believe they don't know who you are, but
gotcha.
Who knows? Yep. So you might disclose more information, which might be important. Gee, I feel dizzy every morning. I won't disclose to my doctor that I had 6 whiskeys the night before, but
right.
that might be a factor. Yeah.
But the internet already knows. and your car reported your driving habits also. So.
Right.
And the stop at the liquor store and I paid
exactly.
with that.
Exactly, GPS
with
the, data. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I know what you did last summer, right?
Yeah, right. You know, and we all want to keep part of our lives very private and not tell anybody. But, you know, we leave traces wherever we go.
Yeah.
And I really don't believe that anybody is off the grid anymore.
Well, we're running out of time, so I think we're going to have to wrap up a little bit. Is there any last words, Jim or Stephanie?
I guess I'll just observe that this is a topic that IEEE deals with in a variety of areas. I'm active in the Society on Social Implications of Technology, which is one place where we discuss specifically the kinds of privacy issues and social issues that come up with this kind of discussion. The Computer Society obviously deals with a lot of the technical issues that go into the question of how do you actually manage big data sets? What are the tool sets? What are the technologies that provide both hardware and software capability? And just...
Well, I think it's sort of too late about to worry about the spread of big data mm-hmm. or the spread of use of big data.
Right.
Because it's happening and there's nothing much that we can do about it. Probably if a person is feeling very uncomfortable with that idea, that should be something that should be addressed on a more... systemic and structural level, like putting in controls of how this data is going to actually be used rather than.
Well, thank you both for joining me this month. Folks, if you're listening and you like what you're hearing, you might want to consider becoming an IEEE member. Check us out at IEEE-NH.org. All right. Thanks for joining us this month and look forward to having you again next month. This has been the November edition of Tech IE. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.